Mindy has been in Las Vegas this last week, so I'm flying solo for this installment. Now, I've wanted to talk about Get Out since I first saw it. I watched it in the theater twice, which is incredibly rare for me. And now that it's on Blu-ray, I have new reason to talk about it yet again. It was intimidating how much I liked it and how important I think it is. By now, I've read a few articles and listened to a few interviews with Jordan Peele, and I've got some thoughts to share and clips to play. For the first half of this, I'll be speaking spoiler-free, not getting any more specific than the TV commercials or the trailers ever got. Now, if I can just get up on this soapbox. I grew up a mixed-race kid in the suburbs of New Jersey, with a black Puerto Rican dad and a white Jewish mother. When I was little, I liked to sit in on conversations on race and sometimes politics. Race as a subject matter is infinitely interesting to me, but I don't pretend I'll ever fully understand it or see all the angles. American history fascinates me, but it does not fill me with any kind of patriotic glow, really. This country's history of slavery is still often misunderstood, I think partly because there's never been a real watershed moment, because slavery was followed by Reconstruction and then Jim Crow laws, which legally relegated African Americans to second-class citizenship. If you're interested in the subject matter, it's covered in Michael Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and recently Ava DuVernay's new documentary on Netflix, The 13th. So back to targeted discrimination and crippling social mobility. Perfectly legal, up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That said, a formal apology for slavery and Jim Crow wasn't issued until 2008. That is a long time to be holding that shit in. And it would be naive to think that we're all on equal playing ground now. Because of social media and the proliferation of camera phones, the rest of the country is now seeing what the black community has been dealing with through over 200 years of systematic oppression. It really is a surreal landscape where the collective words black lives matter is a controversial statement. I'm just saying. Germany acknowledged the atrocities of the Holocaust. There were the Nuremberg trials, the creation of Israel, and actual reparations. Over six decades, Germany paid $89 billion in compensation to victims of Nazi crimes. There has been no such gesture from the American government. I realize this is potentially touchy material, and of course other communities have bad histories with the American government. The country is very big and very old. At some point, it has oppressed every minority class. Because race is an old, taboo subject, there are a number of pitfalls and opportunities for tension and horror, especially when you play with whose point of view we're looking through. Jordan Peele coined the term social thriller, and that brings to mind 70s classics like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or if I had to make an SAT analogy, I'd say Jordan Peele's Get Out is to race in 2017 what Rosemary's Baby and the Stepford Wives was for feminism and women's liberation in 1975. Is that too much? Eh. For those interested, the interview clips I pulled are from a mix of Nerdist interviews with Chris Hardwick and his interview on Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
I basically boiled down all my favorite movies. You know, I did. I tried to take a page out of the Tarantino book and say, like, don't shy away from my favorite moments, my favorite devices, the way the masters have inspired me. If I can figure out a way to, create a cohesive new story, there's something genuinely unique and special about it. So for me, it was Stepford Wives, Rosemary's Baby, really Ira Levin material. Mm-hmm. But then there's, you know, there's different scenes I'm pulling from different things. I definitely go, you know, like the way that the Overlook is a monster that hangs over The Shining. I tried to, like, you know, use the house in this movie in that way. You know, the first scene of the film takes place in, you know, this white suburban neighborhood. And I was talking about Halloween while we were shooting that scene the whole time and trying to capture that eeriness.
Written and directed by Jordan Peele from Key and Peele, Keanu, and Mad TV before that.
The beauty of horror and comedy as well, to me, as art forms to deal with social messages,
is that there's a built-in sort of contract with the audience and the filmmaker that with those genres, I might cross the line a little bit.
Right.
There's an irreverence that's expected. This person made this movie for me. I went into the movie knowing it was meant to horrify me. So I'm already part of this conversation. And if it's effective, you know, that's what, you know, Keegan and I always felt like with comedy. It's you can talk about anything if you get the laugh.
Right.
If you don't get the laugh, you shouldn't have gone there.
Just a quick detail to start us off. A month before they were supposed to begin shooting in L.A., they had to change locations to Alabama. For budget reasons, they needed the tax breaks. Still, with this shakeup, Jordan Peele's feature film directorial debut was still only filmed in 28 days. Even with this incredible cast, that's only 4 weeks. Rosemary's Baby took twice that. Here's a synopsis. Chris and his girlfriend Rose go upstate to visit her parents for the weekend. At first, Chris reads the family's overly accommodating behavior as nervous attempts to deal with their daughter's interracial relationship. Imagine Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but modern. As the weekend progresses, a series of increasingly disturbing discoveries leads him to a truth he never could have imagined. This is one of my favorite casts, probably ever. The acting is great, and it's crucial because for this story to work, it needs to feel familiar. It needs to feel grounded in reality.
At some point, I realized that the movie, I Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, was really the perfect starting point for this film. I think one of the reasons that film was it resonated so powerfully is that it's a universal situation. Take race out of it, we can all relate to the fears of meeting our potential in-laws for the first time and the feelings like we might not be what is expected. So I just thought it was a great entry point to help make this movie inclusive, to help make it something that you don't have to be African-American to emotionally connect to the main character here.
Our main character, Chris, is played by Daniel Kaluuya. He's an English actor you might recognize from his first season episode of Black Mirror, 15 Million Merits, where he rides a bike to power the media compound. And he played Emily Blunt's partner in Sicario. Allison Williams is here playing Rose, presumably a nod to Rosemary's Baby, a direct influence, and a movie that deals with exploitation and control, but from the angle of its impact on women. Pretty early, Rose and Chris have a conversation about her parents' expectations because Chris is the first black guy she's dated. Do they know that? Are they okay with that?
You said I was the first black guy you ever dated.
Yeah, so what?
Yeah, so it's his uncharted territory for him. You know, I don't want to get chased off the lawn with a shotgun.
You're not going to. First of all, my dad would have voted for Obama a third time if he could have. Like, the love is so real. I'm only telling you that because he's definitely going to want to talk to you about that. And it will definitely fucking suck. But that's because he's a lame dad more than anything else.
Bradley Whitford plays Rose's dad, Dean Armitage. Whitford has been one of my favorite actors since he was Josh Lyman on The West Wing. I'm a big, big fan. And here he is so good and willing to play sometimes off-putting lame dad. Seemingly good intention, but he's trying really hard. On the tour, he shows off the house with deer heads on the walls and souvenirs from their world travels.
These have been in Bali.
That's pretty eclectic. I'm a traveler, and I can't help it. I keep bringing souvenirs back.
It comes off as overcompensating, kind of like, look, see how open-minded we are? Catherine Keener plays the matriarch, Missy Armitage. Keener is such a transformative actress that it never feels like she's acting. When she speaks, they don't feel like lines she's memorized. She is inhabiting that skin and saying those words as they come to her. She wields vocal control like a sorceress over everyone. And like the best, sneakiest magic, it's invisible.
You want to know how it works?
Georgina, the maid, is played by Betty Gabriel, and hers is probably my favorite performance. She has a few memorable scenes that are as tragic and haunting as anything you'll typically find in an Oscar Beatty movie. Then, when she needs to be, she scares the shit out of you. Finally, Little Rel Howery plays Rod, the voice of the audience. It's pretty rare that we get a savvy character in a horror movie that's also actually funny. Randy in Scream works because he's kind of a pathetic underdog. Here, Rod is high on his horse because he's a TSA agent. Bragging about TSA training is like being proud of your collection of Nickelback t-shirts.
Right, so I do all my research, you know, because as a TSA agent, you know, you guys are detectives, I got the same training, you know. We might know more than y'all sometimes, you know, because we're dealing with some terrorist shit. So, but that's a totally different story. So, look, I go do my detective work, right? And I start putting pieces together. And see, this is what I came up with.
All right, let's get into the story. A lot has been written and said about the opening scene and how it feels like a direct parallel of Trayvon Martin's death at the hands of George Zimmerman. The case in Florida where a paranoid zealot went after a 17-year-old kid. In Get Out, the young black man we're following is pursued by a white sports car and then pounced on, choked out, and dragged off into the car. In those moments, the audience walks in those shoes, feeling what it's like to be stalked and hunted down in a serene, suburban setting.
Okay, I just keep on walking, bro. Don't do nothing stupid, just keep on. Fuck this. I'm gonna go the other way. I can't. Not today. Not me. You know how they like to do motherfuckers out here, man. I'm gone. Come on, bro.
Yo! Yo!
Now, we can all relate to the nervousness of meeting a significant other's parents for the first time. And by now, you know that Chris and Rose are an interracial couple. So we are going along for the ride on which our protagonist might be on the defensive, spending the weekend with potentially hostile people. How's that for tension? When Chris and Rose are on their way to her parents' place upstate, she's driving and Chris is in the passenger seat when a deer runs across their car. They hit it, but no real damage is done to the car, mostly just the deer. Chris goes to the side of the road to have a look where the deer landed, and this is the first time we see deer imagery in the movie. When Chris sees the dying deer, he has a subtle reaction. We don't know what he's thinking, but the wheels are turning. Cut to the cop who responds to their call.
Sir, can I see your license, please?
Wait, why?
Yeah, I have state ID.
No. He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
No. Fuck that. You don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Maybe be me some cake. Come on.
Anytime there's an incident, we have every right to
That's
ask.
That's bullshit.
Ma'am,
These days, the visual of a cop dealing with a black man at the side of a car is a loaded one. Here, Rose asserts herself, comfortable enough in her role to talk back to the cop and even curse, all without escalating the situation. Chris does not have that luxury. In that moment, sure, Rose is asserting her white privilege, seemingly for good, standing up for her man. Or, when she argues with the cop about Chris showing his ID, she might be avoiding a paper trail. Once everybody's met, Bradley Whitford goes into this rant about deer being a menace. It's surprisingly without compassion.
I say one down, a couple hundred thousand to go.
Yeah.
No, I don't mean to get on my high horse, but I'm telling you, I do not like the deer. I'm sick of it. They're taking over. They're like rats. They're destroying the ecosystem. I see a dead deer on the side of the road. I think to myself, that's a start.
I don't even understand that.
I'm just saying. Like, you know what? I am grateful for what you've done today. I don't like him.
He's supposed to be this bleeding heart liberal, but in saying he wishes all those deer dead, he's oddly trying to be on his daughter's side, but it kind of plays like he's posturing as an alpha male or maybe trying to be edgy dad. Either way, he's getting there by showing no empathy to the dead deer because they are only a nuisance with no redeeming value. I was consistently impressed by how effective the setups are and thinking that horror and comedy have so much in common when it comes to timing and surprise and playing with expectation. Jordan Peele came from 5 seasons of Key and Peele, a Chappelle Show level sketch show, but they also did a lot of sketches that paid homage to Alien and zombie movies and even The Exorcist.
Yeah, the gestation period for this idea was, you know, kind of spanned several years. And I think one of the most important milestones in that process was just realizing that, you know, every true horror, human horror, American horror, has a horror movie that deals with it and allows us to face that fear. And except race, in a modern sense, hadn't been touched. You know, it really hadn't been touched, in my opinion, since Night of the Living Dead 50 years ago. Maybe with the film Candyman. And that, to me, I just saw a void there. So it really started with this notion of, like, this has to be possible. Let's figure it out.
This movie feels like a great band's first album. The band has been learning to write songs together. They're taking chances, figuring out their art. All their life experience up to adulthood goes into that first album. And I'm really excited that Jordan Peele has a few of these social thrillers in the works because clearly he's put a lot of time and thought into these projects. Composer Michael Abels wrote the main theme, Sikiliza Kwa Wahenga. It's sung in Swahili, with the exception of the English word brother. According to Abels, the voices in the song represent the African slave elders trying to warn Chris to get away. The translation of the lyrics goes, "Brother, run. Listen to the elders. Listen to the truth. Run away. Save yourself." The garden party is what Rose was dreading.
Wait, holy shit, that's this weekend?
Yes, this weekend.
No, what day together?
Oh, my God. George, it's Rose's grandfather's party.
My dad with her shindig once a year, get all his friends together.
Her parents' old, white, country club friends assembling and the awkward conversations that'll follow.
Yeah, you know, a part of being black in this country and you know, I presume being any minority is constantly being told that we're being too aware of race somehow. We're obsessed with it, or we're seeing racism where there just isn't racism. So it was important to me to, first of all, put the entire audience on the same page of what it feels like to be aware of these little subtle interactions and the sort of underlying racism that is sort of like just being even slightly distracted or to be made aware of your own race in a normal conversation. So, I sort of teach the audience early on that, you know, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, is he's nervous about meeting these parents and he's nervous that she hasn't told them that he's black. From that point forward, any little whatever you want to call it, microaggression, you know, sort of lame reaching out to make a connection, it becomes aware to the audience, and we get the giggles of awareness from audiences.
And here is where we run through a number of tone-deaf conversations between the friends of the Armitages and Chris. We get questions about athletic and sexual prowess and assurances of other black friends. Everything short of people asking to touch his hair.
Nice to meet you, Chris. Nice to meet you indeed.
Oh, that's quite a grip.
Thank you. You too.
You ever play golf?
Once, a few years ago. I wasn't very good.
Gordon was a professional golfer for years.
Oh, you kidding? Well, I can't quite swing the hips like I used to, though. But I do know Tiger.
Oh, that's great. Secret. Gordon loves Tiger.
Oh, best I've ever seen, ever. Hands down. So, Chris, let's see your form.
They're seemingly friendly enough and curious, so it doesn't come off as hostile, but their small talk is exclusively about his blackness, and we're along for that objectifying, cringe-inducing ride. Like I said, on the surface, the partygoers might seem curious and well-intentioned, but these people have creepily moved beyond to fetishization. Eventually, Chris sees another young black man at the party and moves towards him.
It's... Oh, where are my manners? Logan. Logan King. Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
That's nice.
Now, earlier when Chris spends some time talking to Walter, the groundskeeper, played by Marcus Henderson, he's looking for a little solidarity, but he gets none.
I guess I had too much in that wine last night. Can't really remember. So. Well, I should get back to work. And mind my own business.
These two conversations were strange and disconnected because something in those other guys is off, based on my preconceived assumptions about how black people act. This is a fascinating device, and it comes up in my favorite scary movies with paranoia at their heart. In this case, it's challenging the audience's assumption about what we expect a black guy to sound like. It feels right for the setting, which is to say country club white, but not the person saying it, a young black man. And even that is falling into the prejudice of what a black voice is supposed to sound like. During the garden party, Chris goes upstairs to find his phone unplugged when he definitely left it plugged in. He suspects Georgina unplugged it because she's been acting weird.
She unplugged my phone.
Who?
Georgina. I came here to talk to Rod and I got no juice.
So you think she did that because...
Maybe she doesn't like the fact that I'm with you.
Really?
It's a thing.
When trying to explain why Georgina might have issues with Chris being there, he reaches for a stereotype that black women don't like seeing white women with black men. It's an unnecessary dig at an already marginalized group. Just saying. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you've probably heard mention of this sunken place, right? Regarding the meaning of the sunken place, Jordan Peele said, "The sunken place means we're marginalized. No matter how hard we scream, the system silences us." In Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, he wrote, "I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me." Jump ahead to a time where black men and women are accepted public figures and presidents even, so long as they stay non-threatening. Not seeing race, that fun new adage, is incredibly dismissive. It's a luxury position to come from where you can simply pretend it doesn't exist because it doesn't affect you. It's dismissive of maybe the biggest contributing factor that impacts how people are treated. Appearance, one's skin color, isn't something they get to forget because it affects them all the time.
There's many, as you know, there's a lot of layers going on. The movie kind of continues to unfold, I think, for people over the next couple of days after they sit and think about it. You know, my goal here was first and foremost to entertain people, just to get a movie that sort of addressed the horror movie audience and all of us that just wants to be like, get out the house, you know, pick up the phone and call the cops, you know, stop walking backwards. towards a dark doorway.
Too bad we can't stay.
Yeah. Right. And of course, you know, I was alluding to that, you know, because in that bit, he references the Amityville, get out.
And the white people are always like, hang on a minute, let's see what we
can do. And then what, black people, get out. Too bad we can't stay.
In Amityville Horror, a ghost told them to get out the house. White people stayed in there. Now that's a hint and a half for your ass. A ghost, they get the fuck out. I would just tip the fuck out the door. They walked and looked in the toilet bowl. Was blood in the toilet? I said, that's peculiar. I would have been in the house and said, oh, baby, this is beautiful. We got a chandelier hanging up here. Kids outside playing. It's a beautiful neighborhood. We ain't got nothing to wear. I really love them. This is really nice. Too bad we can't stay, baby.
I love the rewatchability component that comes with the layers of the story. You watch it once, maybe in the theater, and so much of the impact is because of the surprises in the story. You might absorb it and have it heightened by the crowd, but once you're familiar with it, then there's the relaxed look at it, where you're no longer guessing or anticipating where the story is going, so instead you're kind of running at the same pace. You can even be more in the moment, or less, there's something to be said for that. After you've absorbed the story, maybe your eyes wander away from the protagonist to other places in the frame. You might notice background actors adding to the atmosphere or times where people are speaking in metaphors. On that note, this next segment gets very specific, so there are spoilers involved. This is your spoiler warning. Okay, so we know the twist. Old white people seeking to extend their lives in the bodies of African Americans.
You did it. You cut up his brain, you bloody baboon! Shut it!
It's important that this wasn't a story about a white guy who's trapped in the body of a black guy, treated the way black people are, and oh, isn't it terrible? Anyway, it's been done. Have we forgotten C. Thomas Howell's movie Soul Man? Well, it wasn't supposed to be a horror movie. But it's important because representation matters. Chris isn't a perfect person. He's not idealized or turned into the magical Negro archetype. He's relatable because he's human. He's flawed, but he's smart.
It was definitely clear, like, people need to know this is from a black writer and director. It's a different movie if a white guy did it. But this, you know, what I think is brave about the producers, you know, from Universal, Blumhouse, QC, about this movie is to take a fresh perspective and give me a platform.
Okay, going back to Georgina's subtle breakdown. During the garden party, Georgina has to answer for unplugging Chris's phone, seemingly the first obvious move to isolate Chris, leaving him stranded at the Armitage house. This is my second favorite scene in the movie, and Betty Gabriel seemingly did that whole scene in one long take. There are cuts back to Chris, but the performance flows. In the span of a minute, her facade buckles.
Something. That's not my experience. Not at all. The Armitages are so good to us. They treat us like family.
Maybe the original woman who's deep in the sunken place behind those eyes is fighting, trying to claw at the surface. If that is the case, it's this tragic moment where a prisoner is fighting desperately trying to get out and the guard at the gate is struggling to pretend nothing's wrong. All that plays out in a few words, but mostly it's just on her face. Then that minor meltdown serves as an antecedent to the Logan freakout at the party.
Get out. Sorry, man.
Okay.
Get out!
Yo!
Yo!
Chill, man.
Chill!
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 Chill, man!
Chill! Chill!
Chill!
The silent auction was some next-level fucked-up shit that is so well choreographed. When it happens, we're not sure what they're bidding on. You just know it can't be good. Considering the context, it has to be horrible. Then when they pan down and reveal it's Chris who they're bidding on. Now, with the country's history, one can't but compare this moment to slave auctions, because they are literally bidding on Chris's body. I haven't seen objectification like that since the NFL draft. But this moment also reframes the earlier scenes where people are squeezing Chris's arm and asking to see his golf swing. Creepy. After their thwarted escape, when Chris wakes up in the basement, he's got a deer head looking straight at him. This kind of ominous foreboding serves as a reminder of the victim and trophy Chris is about to become. Now, I guess we've definitely seen a mounted deer head used for murder in a movie before, but I think usually someone's being thrown into a wall with a wall-mounted deer, or whatever that animal villain did with all the antlers. Anyway, more deer as metaphors. Because I feel like most things in this movie are deliberate, I don't think it's a coincidence that in order to escape, Chris literally has to pick cotton from the arm of the chair. He also escapes in a white car, but that seems less important. A few more words about Allison Williams as Rose. I was really impressed because she's got one of the toughest jobs in the story, because her betrayal cuts the deepest. I have to imagine it's a top-notch acting-directing duo who made her so convincing, because we think of Rose and Chris as partners. We believe she's working in Chris's best interest until they are almost out the door.
Rose.
I don't know where they are.
Rose! Rose! Rose, give me those keys! Rose, give me... Rose, now! Now, the keys!
Oh, be careful, bro.
What the fuck?
I didn't do anything.
What the fuck is going on?
Where are those keys, Rose?
You know I can't give you the keys, right, babe?
Then she goes all Patrick Bateman in her white button-down shirt, eating dry Fruit Loops like a goddamn sociopath. And that goes back to the deer motif again in the movie. Georgina jumps in front of the car, Chris hits her, and then she resembles what Chris's mom must have looked like dying on the side of the road, so he's compelled to help her. Unlike the deer, he can save her. Then she has that horrifying reawakening inside the car.
You ruined my...
Later, Grandpa comes steamrolling down the street after Chris gets the flash reset and then shoots Rose, and then Allison Williams creeps us out that one last time with that eerie smile during her choking, like she's getting off looking Chris in the eye on her way out. Ugh. But Chris can't kill her, and we get a great red herring of the cop car pulling up. Now, we're conditioned to think that that same cop from earlier in the movie might come back into play. Maybe he'll go from racist cop to our hero, like Matt Dillon in Crash. But no, it's so much better because Rod figured out where Chris was.
How you find me? I'm T.S. motherfucking A. We handle shit. That's what we do. Consider this situation fucking handle.
And Chris is satisfied to leave Rose to die the same way his mother died, the same way the deer died. So that's all I've got on Get Out. I really love the movie. If you made it this far, then you've seen the movie as well, and I hope you dug it as well. I really look forward to this sort of gaining the greater context of history, because I think it's as good a film as Rosemary's Baby. I really was thoroughly impressed. I think it's a better film than, say, like The Stepford Wives, which, you know, in message was great and important, but in execution felt like it never got very deep into the subject matter. But Get Out really hits all the notes, and I was so thoroughly impressed. So that'll do it for me. This is me, Darren, signing off.